How is everybody doing? Welcome back to another episode of The Banker Next Door. I am your host, Dr. Joe Berquist. This is the Lords of Easy Money series, and we are continuing here with part 17. And tonight we're going to be covering chapter 14 as we come down the stretch here, which is including chapter 14 tonight. We've only got three more chapters left here to cover to the end of the book. My plan here is this week I'm releasing episodes 13 and 14. I'm sorry, chapters 13 and 14, episodes 16 and 17. And next week, I will release the final two chapters, chapters 15 and 16. And then the following week after that, I'm going to do a final wrap-up kind of review. And what I want to do is kind of the book kind of ends in 2021. So I want to do kind of a reflection on the book. And then I also want to bring people current as to, you know, what's happened here over the last 3 years and where are we at currently and how does all this kind of interconnect and interlink together. So, so let's bring in our trusty PowerPoint slide here. So I'm going to do a quick review of what happened in chapter 13. So we started off on September 13th, 2019, and there was a panic at the New York Federal Reserve Bank, particularly the trading desk at the New York Federal Reserve Bank. The global markets for U.S. dollars or the money markets basically had started to melt down. And in particular, the repo market, where basically we saw a spike in repo rates. And we basically then we got into how the Fed historically utilized the repo market and basically how that had become irrelevant because of all the quantitative easing, because of how much money the Fed had pumped into the system. It was basically like if you had a small cup of water in a room and with QE, basically it was like pumping the water full of the whole room full of water. So that you got this little glass floating around this room full of water now. So it made it completely irrelevant. And then we talked about how the Fed had been granted new powers in October of 2008 as part of the TARP Act. Which was part of the $700 billion bailout, which was during the financial crisis. And basically how nobody was really necessarily, at least the public was not fully aware of those powers because they were buried in that bill people didn't really find out about it for quite a long time afterwards. So then we get into this point where they're trying to figure out what's going on in the repo market. They can't quite figure it out. The repo rates just will not abate. They're not sure what to do. And then we get into, and then we discover, they find out what happened. The hedge funds had effectively hijacked and had taken over the repo markets. And they did this by using what they called a basis risk trade, where they basically, you know, borrowed money to go and then to make, and they borrowed cash to then buy the treasuries and then leverage that up with futures contracts. And basically they had, you know, leveraged it up, to, you know, 10 times over. And so then the Fed decided in their wisdom that they needed to come in and they needed to bail out these hedge funds because these hedge funds were going to totally destroy the entire financial system. And what's worse is the Fed came in and they basically covered this all up with what they called non-QE. I refer to it as like, it's almost like Jeremy Powell sitting there like a cheap magician on the side of the street. And he's got his three little cups and it's like, okay, which cup is which cup is my QE under, you know? Well, this is QE, but it's not QE, but it looks like QE and it walks like a duck and it looks like a duck and it sounds like a duck, but it's not a duck. It's not a duck. It's a non-duck. After all this happens, we finally catch up with Tom at the end. Tom is very irritated because he basically realizes they're trapped. You know, they've basically trapped themselves in this system, and all the things that he had worried about coming in here at the end of 2019 were things that he had predicted a decade earlier back in 2010. And he had basically everything that he was afraid of had effectively come true. So now that brings us now to basically March of 2020, and we're going to start here with chapter 14, the infection. This chapter is always basically all about the coronavirus hitting and then what ultimately happened there. So Okay, so let's get in here. So the first waves of volatility arrived on U.S. shores in January of 2020 with the strange news coming from the industrial city of Wuhan, China. The first dispatches had a science fiction quality to them. A mysterious pneumonia-like disease prompted the communist authorities to shut down train service and flights to and from a city of 11 million people. Cable news shows carried weird images of backhoes and cranes and construction sites where China's government was building new hospitals, apparently to accommodate the infected. The financial types on Wall Street tried to digest this news and figure out what it meant for the economy. Jim Bianco, an investor in Chicago, grew alarmed in early January. He was worried that the virus might shut down China's gargantuan manufacturing sector, which was the workhorse of the world. If Chinese factories were closed for months, it could interrupt the supply of medicines, iPads, toys, and television sets. It might even precipitate a recession. What seemed to concern Bianco even more was the general attitude on Wall Street, where the virus was treated like an afterthought. People seemed to believe that the virus would be contained quickly, like the SARS epidemic in 2003. Then very bad news came out of Italy. The novel coronavirus was detected in the northern part of the country and was spreading quickly. On February 24th, the Italian government ordered people in the north to cease travel and remain at home. They called it a lockdown, and it was a shocking thing at the time. More people started to worry about the virus and wonder if the problem might spill far outside of China. On February 26th, a U.S. health official turned his concern into a panic. Her name was Nancy Messonnier, and she worked at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. During a conference call with reporters, Messonnier said that the virus was spreading quickly. Humans had no natural immunity to it, and there was no vaccine. The United States was probably going to have to do things like close schools and keep people at home. I understand this whole situation may seem overwhelming and that disruption to everyday life may seem severe, Messonnier said, but these are things that people need to start thinking about now. So now we get it. So the virus begins to hit, and now Wall Street reacts. The traders on Wall Street did start thinking about them now. An investor named Scott Minard, joined the ranks of very worried people like Jim Bianco. Minard was the chief investment officer of Guggenheim Investments, which managed about $246 billion in assets. Minard had a lot of money on the line and had to figure out how to position it in the face of a viral epidemic. People like Minard and Bianco saw a similar picture when they examined the American economy after a decade of ZERP and QE. Corporate debt levels were at a record high, giving companies very little room to maneuver in the face of a downturn. Assets across the board, from bonds to stocks to commercial real estate, were priced to perfection, meaning that they were trading at the very upper limits that could be justified under the most optimistic scenarios. And the investment community had for years been pushing its money in one direction, toward risk, way out onto the thin ice of the yield curve, reaching for the curve, reaching for the yield, reaching for the yield. This system was not well positioned for what appeared to be coming. Corporate America started out from a place of being highly leveraged and being very illiquid, Minard said. The rise of cheap debt had increased fragility in the system. At some point, there was bound to be an exogenous shock to the economy, something that would be totally unexpected, and it was going to cause a massive unwinding in leverage. On Thursday, February 27th, the day after Messonnier sent her warning, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell by nearly 1,200 points, or 4%. It was the worst day in the stock market since 2008. So now the world begins to panic. The mood inside the New York Federal Reserve was surprisingly calm that day. The traders who worked for Lori Logan held their usual meeting in the afternoon where they compared notes and patched in their colleagues from Chicago on the video screen. No one seemed panicked. The waves continued to gain strength until Sunday, March 8th, when the real flood damage began. That afternoon, the government of Saudi Arabia announced it would increase oil production even as oil prices were falling. This was cataclysmic for global oil markets, which were already glutted by excess oil from American frackers. Oil prices crashed. People in the financial world did not sleep well that night because they knew what was coming. Jim Bianco in Chicago realized that there were big differences between the 2003 SARS outbreak and the coronavirus outbreak of 2020. The new outbreak wasn't just worse, it was hitting at a moment when the markets were extraordinarily fragile. This was a bubble in search of a pin, and we found a big pin, Bianco said. On Monday morning, the stock market opened and promptly crashed so hard it triggered an automatic shutdown, halting trading for 15 minutes. This was the first time the trigger had been activated since 1997. Over the next 2 weeks, the shutdown trigger would be activated three more times. The news about the stock market was all very bad, but it did not reflect the full nature of the financial crisis that was started to gather strength on that Monday morning. The real crisis was in the market for U.S. Treasury bills. 10-year Treasury bills are the bedrock of modern finance. On the morning of Monday, March 9th, the interest rate on these Treasury bills convulsed in ways that were previously unthinkable. The previous Friday, 10-year Treasury yields had been 0.76%. On Monday morning, they plunged to 0.31%. Throughout the day, they rose again to 0.6%. These numbers seemed tiny to outsiders, but they were tiny in a way that when a street buckles during an earthquake, it only leaves upward of 5 feet above, it only heaves upward by 5 feet above sea level, then ends the day collapsed 10 feet below sea level. To the people walking on that street, these changes were acutely noticeable. The Treasury bill volatility felt the same way to financial traders. As the Financial Times later put it, such turmoil simply shouldn't be possible in the Treasury market, analysts say. The turmoil largely escaped public notice for several reasons. The Treasury market wasn't as widely discussed as the stock markets, and the Treasury market seized up at the moment when American society shut down. That was the week when the NBA suspended its season and the NCAA canceled its March Madness tournament. Most important, schools began to shut their doors, leaving frantic parents to figure out what to do with their kids. Home offices and remote classrooms were arranged on kitchen tables for the first time. Oh, yes, Lord, I remember that. I don't ever want to live that again. Okay, so let's see here. So the Treasury market, okay, so now I think we get to the Fed's, where are we at here? No, I'm sorry. We got the Treasury market collapses. Let's get to the Treasury market collapses. So inside the Federal Reserve, the Treasury market collapse was an urgent concern. It made the repo market seizure of September seem like a placid event. The Fed analysts could see what the turmoil signified. The financial world was panicking. Everyone was seeking to hold the safest, most easily tradable thing imaginable, cash. People didn't even want to hold treasuries, considered the safest investment on earth. They wanted to liquidate everything, including treasuries, to gather whatever piles of cash they could obtain. This happens when people believe the entire system is on the brink of collapse. This rush to get cash intensified each day. On Thursday, the truly unthinkable happened. Some treasury bills couldn't even find a price, meaning that no one was willing to buy them and trade their cash for them. The broader consequences of this liquidation were enormous and immediate. The hedge funds that had loaded up on basis trade bets were imperiled. They would need to unload whatever assets they had to raise cash at the very moment that everyone else was doing the same thing. The hedge funds seemed to have drawn down some of their basis trade bets since September, but the level of such bets was still historically high. And these weren't the only hedge fund bets that were going bad. A class of hedge funds called risk parity funds had borrowed money to make bets on futures contracts for things like bonds, stocks, and commodities. They allocated their bets in a way that was supposed to reflect the relative risk of each asset, but the simultaneous and once unthinkable downturn in stocks and treasuries scrambled all the equations about relative risk. The risk parity hedge funds found themselves in a squeeze, forced to find cash at the moment when the entire market was hoarding cash. Powell responded to this crisis by authorizing the Fed to respond with nearly unprecedented force. In September, when the repo market had collapsed, the Fed shocked markets by offering $75 billion in repo loans. On Thursday, March 12th, the Fed announced that it would offer $500 billion in repo loans and would offer $1 trillion in repo loans the following day. The Fed was offering $1.5 trillion in immediate assistance to Wall Street. It did virtually nothing to help. The Dow continued to plunge and closed the day down 2,300 points or 10%. On Friday, things were hectic at the Federal Reserve. The Eshel's building would soon close down and the Fed staff and board of governors would be sent home to work remotely. But before that happened, Jay Powell agreed to hold one last emergency meeting. The American financial system had developed a certain muscle memory by this point. When the volatility got out of control, all attention turned to the Federal Reserve. The central bank would meet on Sunday afternoon to figure out how to respond. The massive polished table at the center of the Fed's boardroom gets quite crowded during FOMC meetings. It's considered a status symbol to be seated at the table during meetings rather than occupying a chair along the outside wall. As the Fed created new divisions and senior positions over the years, the crowd at the boardroom table grew larger until they were crowded close together with all of their binders, papers, and cups of coffee. This made the meeting of Sunday, March 15th, all the more striking. The table was virtually empty. Two large video monitors had been erected at either side of the table, and the faces of FOMC board members began to flicker onto the screens as the meeting began. The few staff members who still arrived at the Eshels building sat at the big table, arranged several feet apart from one another. One participant said it was like sitting in a haunted house. The New York Fed staff opened the meeting with an overview of economic conditions. Not surprisingly, this was a horror show. The treasury markets, bond markets, oil markets, and stock markets were all in free fall. The staff focused on three markets that were particularly troubling. The first was corporate debt markets, which appeared to be grinding to a halt, although things hadn't yet gotten as bad as they were in 2008. There was growing stress in markets for commercial mortgage-backed securities, or CMBSs. The loan portfolios that the analyst John Flynn discovered were based on over-optimistic assumptions when he went through all those spreadsheets. The second market they discussed was the treasury market, which had suffered an acute decline in trading. Finally, they discussed the markets for short-term corporate loans, or short-term commercial paper, as it is generally called. These loans were supposed to be traded almost as easily as cash, but these markets were also seizing up. The FOMC members began to discuss what they ought to do about this. When faced with a viral pandemic, the Fed had very limited tools at its disposal. The Fed could not give money to hospitals nor to people who were being laid off or told to stay at home. The Fed could not slow the virus's passage nor help produce the materials for face masks, which were in such direly short supply. When considering such problems, the Fed could look to its own past actions. One of the lessons the Fed took from the 2008 crisis was that it was better to move faster and bigger. They moved too slowly in 2008, said Claudia Shim, a former senior economist at the Fed who participated in a series of lessons learned studies inside the bank that examined the 2008 response. When the Fed did break through the zero bound and employed tools like quantitative easing, this made it easier to do so again. Now the Fed had a suite of tools to use and had practiced using them. Oh, baby, they did. And the theory was that the quicker these tools were employed, the better things would be. The best option that you have to short circuit a recession and make it less severe is right at the start. This thinking appears to have become predominant inside the Fed's leadership team. That Sunday in March, Jay Powell and his team proposed a sweeping set of actions. So now... So now we're still talking about the Fed's response here. So Powell's Fed would do virtually everything that Ben Bernanke's had done in 2008 and 2009, but this time they did it in one weekend rather than over several months. It slashed interest rates to near zero. It opened up their swap lines with foreign central banks, flooding them with dollars in exchange for their local currencies. This was important because so much global debt is denominated in dollars. It executed a new round of quantitative easing worth a total of $700 billion and bought the bonds at a faster rate than before. The Fed would buy $80 billion worth of bonds before the following Tuesday, meaning that it pushed as much money into the banking system in 48 hours as it had done in the span of a month during earlier rounds of QE. It gave forward guidance, promising to keep rates pinned near zero as long as necessary, and it launched all of this in one day. The FOMC voted almost unanimously to pass the emergency actions. One regional bank president, Loretta Mester of the Cleveland Fed, voted against the plan because she thought the interest rate should have been dropped only as low as 0.5% rather than 0.1%. When the meeting adjourned, Powell hosted a conference call for journalists, announcing the emergency set of measures. His voice was tiny, as if he were calling from overseas, and the whole thing had a very disorganized feel to it. The scale of the Fed's actions was meant to soothe investors, but it appeared instead to terrify them. It was unnerving to hear Powell's voice on Sunday afternoon, an effect that was amplified by the fact that the FOMC had been scheduled to meet the following Tuesday. If the Fed couldn't wait 48 hours to do what it was doing, then things must be really dire. Once again, on a Sunday evening, financial traders experienced surges of adrenaline and started making frantic calls to rearrange their holdings in light of the bad news. They knew what would come when the trading week began. The next morning, markets opened in free fall. The Dow fell by 13%. That was the Monday when the financial crisis, which had started gathering power a week earlier, fully engulfed the economy. So this is basically chaos sets in. So the week of March 16th was when people on Wall Street saw things happening that they didn't think were possible. Scott Minard, the chief investment officer at Guggenheim, was amazed when he saw the market for treasury bills essentially freeze. There had been a similar collapse in the mortgage bond market back in 2008, which led to a global panic and collapse. But to see it happen in the $20 trillion market for ultra-safe treasuries wasn't just scary, it was difficult to comprehend. When somebody like Minard looks at a debt market, they look at something called the spread. The spread is the difference between a seller's price for something and what the buyer is willing to pay. If a person offers to sell a bond for, say, $10, but buyers are willing to pay only $9.90, then the spread is 10 cents or 1%. Typically, the spread on a treasury bill is way less than 1 cent. That's because there are so many buyers and sellers conducting so many trades, which makes finding a price relatively easy. A treasury spread is typically something like 0.031% or 0.016%. During the March crisis, Minard saw the spread on some treasury bills widen to as high as 4%. At some points, the screens that should have shown bids and offers on treasuries just went blank, meaning that no agreed-upon price could be found. This chaotic breakdown filtered out to every kind of debt. The spreads on corporate debt, which is riskier than treasury debt, began to widen quickly. At the height of the thing, the bid offer spread was, in some cases, 30% on corporate debt, Minard said. That is unthinkable. In Chicago, the trader Jim Bianco was basically locked in his home with his family and his dog. The city felt haunted. Weekday traffic slowed to a pace typical during the early morning hours on a Sunday. The financial markets felt similarly shaken and hollowed out. Bianco was very concerned about the health of the big banks, which were the core of the financial system. The stock value of the big banks fell by 48% between the stock market's peak in February and by March 23rd. Shares of JP Morgan Chase, the biggest of the big banks, the largest, most powerful bank in the country, were down by 43% during that time. Really, what we're looking at is destruction in the banking industry that is maybe even bigger than 08, Bianco said. The banks hadn't failed, and they still had a lot of cash in their reserve accounts, but Bianco and others could see that their failure was on the horizon, and the horizon was not too far off. Okay, now we're coming down here to the last few things here. So the eight largest banks react in unison. On Monday, March 16th, the eight biggest banks made a joint announcement that all of them would step forward to take out emergency loans from the Fed's discount window. These banks had bogged down the discussions over living wills and stress tests for years, but they acted with rapidity now. In the past, banks avoided loans from the Fed's emergency lending discount window because taking the loans signaled a weakness. By stepping forward altogether, the banks shielded one another from the stigma of emergency borrowing. The banks said that they didn't need the money immediately, but had made the declaration to keep the option open if they needed it. Bianco estimated that if banks' stocks declined by another 15%, then bank failures would begin. The turmoil revealed the extraordinary weakness that record levels of debt had woven into the fabric of corporate America. Big companies weren't just desperate to get cash to keep their doors open and their lights on during a shutdown. They were desperate to get cash because they had to make regular payments on leveraged loans and corporate bonds that they had taken out at a record pace over the previous decade, encouraged at every step by the Federal Reserve. Corporate bonds had the unforgiving structure that Powell would have learned about during his days at Dillon Reed and at Carlyle. When a company borrowed $1 million in bonds or leveraged loans, it paid only the interest on the debt until the final day it was due, at which point it had to pay off the entire debt or refinance it in the market by selling it and rolling it over. The roll, we talked about the rollover again and again. When the economy shut down, customers stayed home and the cash stopped rolling in. Companies from Southwest Airlines to AT&T to Ford had to pay full interest payments on their full debt loads or face default. So now we're going to talk about what they called the chain of failures. The fragility of the corporate debt markets created an interlocking set of crises, each linked to the next line like a chain that threatened to take down the banking system. The first immediate crisis arose from the indebted corporations that were scrambling to get cash. In their panic, these companies rapidly drew upon a source of emergency debt called a revolving credit facility, basically a line of credit. They tapped their line of credit, which allowed them to quickly borrow cash up to a certain limit. After markets crashed on March 16th, Southwest Airlines drew down a $1 billion revolving credit facility. The hotel operator Hilton drew down $1.75 billion. General Motors the following week would draw down $16 billion. This helped explain why bank stocks fell by almost half in a matter of weeks. The revolving credit facilities threatened to bleed the banks dry, even as they struggled to cope with the market volatility. What was even more troubling to analysts like Jim Bianco was that the lines of credit were still probably insufficient to save many troubled corporations, meaning that the companies would draw cash out of the banks and then take it over the cliff with them when they declared bankruptcy anyway. So in other words, this money wasn't going to save them. But to do a little sidebar for a second, the reason why companies in a crisis will scramble to go grab these, to go advance the lines of credits, is because the first thing the banks will do is take that credit away from them. They'll shut the line of credit down and basically say, oh, sorry, you can't borrow anything. So that's why in a panic, the very first thing companies do is they run to the bank and they draw down their entire line of credit and just take that money and put it in the, and, you know, just put it in the checking account or the savings account and leave it sit there and until they need it. But what Jim Bianco was saying here was that basically, like, what was the point of taking this money? Because it wasn't enough. And all it's going to do, you're just going to take that money with you when you go, when you drive your car right off the cliff. So, and it was a very good point, on very astute point on his part, because that was true at that moment. Okay. The second lane in the chain of failures would happen when companies started to miss debt payments and default on the loans. This would force debt rating agencies like Standard & Poor's and Moody's to downgrade companies like Ford, moving many into the realm of junk debt. A wave of such downgrades looked inevitable, and it carried a grave consequence for the big banks. The downgrades would be like a torpedo in the side of the CLO industry. The banks had been compiling leveraged loans into packages of CLOs and selling them to pension funds, but the banks had also been buying CLOs for themselves. In 2019 alone, the value of CLOs held by big banks jumped by 12% to $99.5 billion. JP Morgan had boosted its own holdings by 57% that year. The vast majorities of these CLO investments were held by three big banks: JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, and Citibank, who together owned about 81% of all CLO bank holdings. That's incredible. The approaching tide of credit downgrades posed a serious risk to the value of these CLOs. Most CLOs contained a contract clause that allowed them to hold only so much junk debt. If more of the leveraged loans inside the CLOs were downgraded, then this would breach the standards of the contracts, and the CLOs would have to start selling off their junk debt and replace it or write down the value of the entire CLO. So the CLO were downgraded, and this would breach the standard of contracts, and the CLO would have to start selling off their junk debt and replace it or write down the value of the whole CLO. The prospect of selling or trying to sell junk debt was sobering. Investors were already dumping assets in a stampede of sales. One financial trader who granted an interview during this period on condition of anonymity sounded shaken after his day at work. He was one of those jaded, even cynical Wall Street types who prided himself on being unsentimental about turmoil in the marketplace. But in mid-March, he had a real tingle of fear in his voice. He said that big investors were selling off assets with a level of desperation that was terrifying. He likened it to watching people sell an apartment building for $100. While it was thrilling to buy an apartment building for $100, it was also unsettling because of what it signified. A mass liquidation was underway and it heralded even worse things ahead. So now we get to the very end, which is the Fed's response is not working. So Powell decided to go where no central bank has ever gone before. Few chairmen of the Federal Reserve were in a better position to understand what was going on than Powell. His long career could be considered an extended training course in the modern financial system and its shortcomings. He had personally helped build and sell big structures of leveraged loans and corporate bonds. He had overseen the division of the Treasury Department that auctioned off government debt, and he had warned for years about the systemic fragility that the Fed was encouraging. In retrospect, one of Powell's warnings took on particular significance. In 2013, he had predicted how hard it would be for the Fed to contain the damage when asset prices corrected. In any case, we ought to have a low level of confidence that we can regulate or manage our way around the kind of large, dynamic market event that becomes increasingly likely thanks to our policy, he had said. The emergency actions Powell initiated on March 15th were a show of overwhelming force by any standard. They were more far-reaching, larger, and faster paced than any previous intervention ever taken by the central bank. But by Friday evening, March 20th, a week of financial carnage proved that the Fed actions weren't enough to stem the panic. By this point, Powell was already designing the next phase of the Fed's bailout, which would push the central bank into areas it had never been to before. The bank would, for the first time, directly purchase corporate bonds, CLOs, and even corporate junk debt. This would expand the Fed put to entirely new realms of the economic system, changing the debt markets from that point forward. This phase of the plan was not debated in formal FOMC meetings, which were transcribed for history. It was hashed out during a series of frantic phone calls between Jay Powell, John Williams at the New York Fed, and Fed officials like Governor Lauriel Bernard. But Powell wasn't just talking to people inside the central bank. Many of his calls were routed to the U.S. Department of the Treasury. If the Fed was going to expand its reach where it needed approval from the Treasury Department. This happened to be a lucky break. The department was run by one of Powell's strongest allies in Washington, Steve Mnuchin. So, very interesting end there, because we had Powell warning that in any case, we ought to have a low level of confidence that we can regulate or manage our way around the kind of large dynamic market event that becomes increasingly likely thanks to our policy. That was his warning for back in 2013. So he knew it. He knew it. They all know it. So then they decide that they're gonna start buying bonds, CLOs, corporate junk debt. They're going to expand the Fed put into every aspect of the economic system. This phase of the plan was, and it was, this was not debated in any FOMC meetings. This was from a bunch of frantic phone calls amongst a couple of people at the Fed. And then they call Steve Mnuchin and said, here's our plan. This is what we're doing. Boom. Now it's easy in hindsight to play Monday morning quarterback and sit there and criticize and say this, that, the other thing. It's hard to operate in the moment, as it were. But I'll kind of save my context here. So this is, like I said, this is kind of the end for chapter 14 here. And I'll kind of end there because there's more that happens here in chapter 15 and 16. So I'll say, you know, hey, look, come back next week. I'm going to be putting out the next two episodes, chapter 15 and 16 next week. And then the following week, I'm going to have basically a wrap up episode to kind of just look back at the book and then also take a step forward and look at kind of what's happened here over the last 3 years and bring us to today and look at, like, OK, where are we at? Why is this all important? How does this all connect together? And we'll all see this whole thing finally come together in one piece. So, but if you like this episode, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe. That would really help the series. It would really help the channel. And like I said, please make sure to come back next week and check out the next two installments of the series as we finally conclude next week and wrap up the final two chapters. And I hope to see everybody again real soon. Thanks a lot.